are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
All righty, I will. Let's take it from the top.
Okay.
First and foremost, it's a program that I've been using with my athletes for over 10 years and my clients. They're not all athletes. And it's an ebook that I put together. It's the culmination of everything I've learned from over 35 years of competing, coaching, obviously exercise science in college, collaborations that I've had with other coaches and athletes. And then a lot of communication with clients over the years. And when someone comes to me and asks me what to do to improve their body composition, their general health, their performance, any of those things, I give them this document. It's something I've been compiling for over a decade. And it's everything I want them to do. It's not just nutrition. That's only one piece of the puzzle. It's about sleep optimization. It's about hydration. Of course, it's their diet. It's about digestion. It's about getting blood tests, improving blood pressure and blood sugar. And then the kind of exercise that I recommend. And it's really comprehensive. And I tell them, I need you to improve all of these facets of your life in order to get the best benefit. It's multifactorial. You can't just do one thing. No diet's going to cure poor sleep habits or lack of exercise. I think it has to be very comprehensive. So what I did is I put together this this document, and when someone asked me to help them, I send them the entire thing. I said, I need you to fix all of these things. And that's what eventually became the vertical diet with all the interaction that I've had. Of course, my personal experience, those are anecdotes, the testimonials from clients, and now having partnered with the head of the dietetic department at UNLV, he's a registered dietitian, PhD, and we went through the entire program and attached over 200 peer-reviewed published research articles to support every aspect of the program. So it's science-based. I'm very careful to, I caution that it's not magic and that there's not much I can do for you. I can tell you what, the best path is, although there's many paths to the same destination. The vertical diet is intended to help you optimize the path that works best for you, because the best diet's the one you'll follow. I've said that compliance is the science. And so I'm not zealous about which diet specifically that you choose, although I do provide you or my clients, what I recommend is the easiest path to follow. The one that handles, of course, your caloric demands, your macronutrient requirements, and your micronutrients to make sure you're healthy. So that's, and that's the big picture of the vertical diet, is that it's intended to help people go from ground zero to, having a diet plan, a menus, grocery shopping list, and something they can implement because they want me to tell them exactly what to do. That's kind of an expectation that someone has when they come to you and ask you for help, that you'll tell them exactly what to eat and exactly how to exercise. And then from there, we refine things based on their response. So I know that's very general, but that's kind of a summary of what the vertical diet is currently.
So see if I have this right. Would you say then the vertical diet is more of a holistic approach? Is that the wrong analogy that I'm using? Because vertical meaning top to bottom or bottom to top, and it seems like it's way more than just a diet. And so maybe I'm getting that wrong.
Yeah, I'm always cautious about attaching certain adjectives. Holistic gets a bad rap in the industry as being anti-science or anti-medicine. Yeah. It's a collaboration. I work closely with people's doctors to, if they do have prescription medication for, blood pressure, blood sugar, and that. Obviously, we like to incorporate lifestyle methods that can help them, eventually get off of those medicines. But yes, it is a lifestyle approach. It certainly is about something that's sustainable, something that is a lifestyle that you can enjoy and live with long term. It's not overly restrictive, although, in order to lose weight, you will have to modify your caloric intake and increase your physical activity. And certainly if you want to retain muscle tissue, you're going to want to do some resistance training. So it's the big rocks, it's the foundation, the fundamentals. Of course, I mentioned sleep along with that. And then I break it down to help them actually be successful in each of those areas. So I don't just say, hey, you need more sleep. I say, well, here's some good sleep hygiene practices, quiet room, cool room, dark room. We talk about how your diet can affect that, how hormones can affect sleep, testosterone, thyroid, those kinds of things, vitamin D. We talk about the necessity of a CPAP if you've got sleep apnea. And I go into, details on how to get a CPAP or how to get tested and what to look for. And, with the stop bang questionnaire, and I try and help them navigate that whole process. So it is really comprehensive that way. I'm the kind of guy that I need a checklist. Just tell me exactly what to do. Yeah. So I provide, a high blood sugar checklist and a high blood pressure checklist, step by step, all of the things that will make you most successful in remedying those health issues. And it's not just weight loss, because a lot of times people really are interested in just improving their sleep or their general health, which is really important. Their immune system, all of those things, particularly now in the wake of COVID, that are, high on people's priority list.
Yeah. Maybe you've answered the question, but vertical. I'm hung up on this vertical. What exactly, how do you tie vertical into your overall program? That's what I guess I'm trying to get to. Maybe you have.
All right. Let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
You know, there's a few ways to look at that. The vertical diet would be, rather than being horizontal or fat, you'd be thin. You'd be more, okay. Some people are, to use analogies like that, rather than being sedentary, you'd be active.
Yeah.
For me, it was more about building a foundation. I mentioned all of the different aspects that are important for being successful in sleep, hydration, nutrition, digestion, all those things. So I built a foundation of highly bioavailable, micronutrient-dense whole foods that are easy to digest. And that's part of everyone's diet, whether it's the husband or the wife, whether you're an athlete or you're a dad bod or a soccer mom. Everybody has the same foundational requirements for micronutrients in particular, vitamins and minerals, those kinds of things. And then I say that upon that foundation, I can build a skyscraper. And to me, that's the vertical diet. I can have a 450-pound world's strongest man, Hafþór Bjornsson and Brian Shaw, who I've worked with, or NFL football player, or UFC fighter, or even a soccer mom who has to get up bright and early and get her kids ready for school, and then she's got to go out and work. Maybe she's working out of the trunk of her car as a real estate agent and being able to navigate packing her meals and having what she needs when she needs it. I work a lot with people on the logistics of making sure that they're able to comply with the program, and then pick them up at school and take them to, music class or their sports events, and not get distracted or thrown off of their own personal needs, and to be able to exercise, to eat healthy, and maintain their body weight and their health and their energy levels are really important. And then make it easy for them to comply. Make it so that it minimizes hunger and it provides them adequate energy. And so I try and design it for them in that way. So I build the foundation, and then upon that, I think we can put just about any demand that's needed, whether it's high calorie or high activity, or even if it's a diet with some caloric restriction, at least making it maintainable for people.
And what I like about what you're saying is that, to a large degree, you're making it user-friendly, because that's what the problem is. With diet, talking about diet, so many of these diets are just so unfriendly that it's impossible to stay on it for very long. And that's why people fail to some degree. And it sounds like, you got to do the work,
There's no question about that. But you're creating a template for me that gives me a way to succeed, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, of course, we need to figure out how many calories that you need. We need to look at what macros might fit your personal preference, because what the research suggests is that once you get adequate calories and protein, where you move fats and carbs really doesn't seem to matter. It's a matter of personal preference. So I designed the diet based on the individual and how I can manage their hunger levels or their personal preference that way.
Right.
And so I work really hard to make sure that it's something that they enjoy and that they can do consistently, because I come from the bodybuilding, powerlifting industry, where I've worked with people who have kind of been professional dieters all their lives, myself included, for over 30 years. I've gained and lost probably over 2,000 pounds.
No,
I've bulked up to over 300 pounds to powerlift, and I've dieted down to under 4% body fat to compete as an IFBB pro bodybuilder. And I did that back and forth for three decades.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot of lessons along the way about how to maintain performance and how it influences energy, how much muscle mass and strength you can gain or lose, how much body fat you can gain or lose, and all the variables that you can influence and adjust to optimize that. And so I try and pass those lessons on to my clients so that they can have a more enjoyable program that they can stick with long term, and tell them what the big rocks are, what's most important. And then along the way, try and resolve, because a lot of people present with digestive distress, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, acid reflux, sometimes hormone problems, hypothyroidism, or low testosterone. And so we try and address those as well, because they're hugely important for people's general sense of well-being and their ability to be successful long-term on the diet.
Yeah, I'm sure you heard Don Ross, the Ripper Ross. You've heard of
him? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Don told me one time at the Gold's Gym, I got to know him really well, and he said, if you really want to know how diet and exercise impacts someone, ask a world-class bodybuilder that's a student of the game. And he's right, because what you're saying is basically that. Where our bodies are our lab and our experiment, and we know how to make macros work, because you've been doing it for so long. I totally get that, One of my questions I have for you, because I did it both ways, and this has nothing to do as much with for health reasons, more for maybe athletic performance. When I was bodybuilding, I did, again, trying everything. There were times when I competed that I ate very clean and competed very clean in terms of my diet, and there were times that I didn't. And to be honest with you, I didn't see that much of a difference when I ate clean compared to when I ate less clean. Do you think that you're a product of what you eat more than you are of how much or how little that you eat?
That's a great question. And let me dive into that by saying that all diets work when they're strictly adhered to. If you create a calorie deficit, you can lose weight. Now, the type of weight you lose will be influenced by how much protein you take in, how much of a deficit that you create, because too much of a deficit might cause muscle tissue loss. And then resistance training, obviously, to retain the lean muscle tissue while you're dieting, because you'll lose some of that, and hopefully not a lot, based on the type of diet that you have. So here's what is traditionally, what people have seen a lot of in the what I call the professional diet industry, bodybuilding, figure, physique, bikini, all of those different people. A lot of what we've seen now is these over-restrictive diets. They eat egg whites, they eat tilapia, they eat broccoli, and almost that's about it for a lot of these people. And, guru coaches tell you to eliminate red meat, to eliminate dairy, to eliminate fruit, to eliminate salt. All of the things that are hugely important for retaining lean body mass, energy, satiation, hormone optimization. So what I think is tragic about this industry is they've used these restrictive diets. And then the girls that are competing, the girls in particular, because they're on lower calorie diets than the men will eat more food. And so it's less likely they'll suffer from the micronutrient deficiencies. The women in particular will suffer from the female triad. They'll have a cessation of the menstrual period, amenorrhea. They'll have low iron, anemia. They'll have low calcium, and they'll end up with, you know, symptoms from all of those things, obviously, the energy loss, the fatigue, the potential for, you know, for athletes in particular, like long distance runners, may get chin splints as a result of the calcium loss and the frailty of the bones. Now, these women, they get on stage in their bikinis, and the general population sees pictures of them, the soccer moms at home, and they see these women in the best shape of their life, and then they start to try and follow the diet that these women used, the egg whites, the tilapia, the broccoli, and they don't see behind the scenes all of those health problems that have manifested as a result of those micronutrient deficiencies. So that's what I think is tragic. That's what I'm kind of railing against with the vertical diet. It's not magic. It's what Vince Guaranda was talking about in the 60s with eat red meat, eat whole eggs, you know, get some sea kelp for iodine, you know, so that you don't have a thyroid issues. I use those foundational foods, red meat in particular, over as a preferential food source for women, as opposed to boneless, skinless chicken breast or tilapia, because it's 3 times higher in iron, 6 times higher in B12, 9 times higher in zinc. So that can help manage some of the anemia problems, some of the energy loss. Whole eggs instead of egg whites, because they're full of biotin. That's for your skin, hair, and nails. Choline for your liver. Vitamin K2. You see a lot of these women that get hypothyroidism from an iodine deficiency, and then that dry skin, hair, and nails from the biotin deficiency starts falling out. Yeah. And they end up losing their hair. And so I get iodine in the diet, and I keep those whole foundational foods in there. Dairy, very important for calcium intake, and not just that, but it's important for performance, for nerve signaling, for muscle contraction. So I keep that in the diet. Some women who can't handle milk because of lactose intolerance, over 90% of people can handle a good quality Greek yogurt because it's much lower in lactose and it has some of the digestive enzymes in there. And so I'll substitute that for them. So I'm pretty strategic about creating that foundation so I don't end up, as these women are dieting, I don't end up with people that get, you know, are progressively experiencing more and more health problems. They get extremely hungry, they get very tired, and then they end up at the doctor's office getting prescriptions or shots for D3, iron, you know, prescriptions for thyroid medication, and it's entirely unnecessary. It's tragic. And so, and in addition to that, a lot of these girls will do a ton of cardio, and sometimes at the sacrifice of sleep. And when you sacrifice sleep, you burn more muscle than fat, and it has a dramatic effect on your insulin and your IGF-1. So you're partitioning nutrients towards fat instead of muscle. And so I don't prescribe any 4 a.m. cardio. I don't prescribe any extended 40-minute twice-a-day cardio at all. I believe in weight training first. I utilize 3 10-minute walks a day after each meal to help with blood sugars, and that's about the extent of the cardio that I use, even for competitors on the Olympia stage. I trained Nadia Wyatt, who took third in the Miss Olympia, and she placed third in the Miss Olympia doing 3 10-minute walks a day, eating steak, potatoes, oranges, salting all of her food every single day. She sends me pictures of her meals, and she's stronger. She carries more muscle. She has more energy. She's healthier. She doesn't rebound after the show with an extraordinary amount of, you know, edema, water retention, and fatigue, and fat regain. So it's a strategy that I use with all of my athletes so that they are healthy. Like you said, you can eat quote unquote clean, which can manifest in all of those micronutrient deficiencies, as I mentioned, or you can, you know, as long as you maintain a calories deficit, you can still incorporate some of the foods that you've always enjoyed and are probably more nutrient dense, such as the steak and the whole eggs and all those things. So that's the nuts and bolts of it when you get down to the specifics.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying that's really important is that you can't eat too you can eat too clean if you do for too long a period of time because of the things that you've said, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. No. You know, one of the best shows that I came in was when I was doing the I did the anabolic diet, the high fat diet. I was with Mauro DiPasquale. And I was going 5 days where I was doing the high fat diet. And then 2 days on the weekend, I would carb load. And my carb load was, there was nothing off the table. I'd go to McDonald's and, whatever I wanted for carb loading. And I came in the best shape that I ever came in to any show. And one of the mistakes, and I know you know this, what we did as bodybuilders is so many times that we would do something, a training regimen, leading into a competition, you know, pre-contesting. And in the last 2 or 3 days, we start fucking around with things that we never did, like carb depletion, carb loading, mm-hmm. 2 days that you never did. So your body wasn't used to it. It did just exactly what you're talking about. All of a sudden you blow up and you have water all over the place because it wasn't used to that. But because of the fact that I was doing this 5 days on high fat, 2 days carb loading, I did that all the way into the day of the show. And I came in really good. I felt, you know, it was the first time I felt good competing. All these other times I felt lousy, you know? And it's like, oh, I've been there. What's wrong with that?
I've been there. I started competing in 1986 in bodybuilding. And I've done dozens and dozens of shows over the years, bodybuilding and powerlifting. I know what it's like to over-restrict and how I feel and to lose a lot of muscle and to have no energy and to be just starving all the time. And on the flip side, because I work with a lot of strength athletes, powerlifters, bodybuilders, strongmen, pro football players, linemen, Lane Johnson from the Philadelphia Eagles, and I mentioned the world's strongest men, Hofthor Bjornsson and others. And I was a powerlifter, a world record powerlifter for many years. And so I would bulk up in the off season to try and gain weight. And there's a right way and a wrong way to do that too. And what I discovered from all of my mistakes that I made, and throughout my career, I've had over 150 blood tests. And so I was very keen and very in touch with exactly what was going on with me. And a lot of times what happens with these big athletes is they overeat. And these guys experience the other side. The over-restriction causes metabolic adaptation and a lot of those health issues. Eating too much, too fast, and putting on too much body fat causes metabolic syndrome.
Yeah.
And that's when people end up with fatty liver disease, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high cholesterol. And that's when Hofthor came to me 4 years ago. He said, Stan, I'm getting fatter, not stronger. And I immediately knew that I'd experienced it myself, and I have the education and the experience to know that he was suffering from these problems. And so we do a blood test, and we see all of the markers that indicate that he's got metabolic syndrome. And so we actually started dieting all of our athletes down, even our big athletes, our football players and strongmen. We would bring their weight down enough to resensitize them so that they wouldn't have insulin resistance anymore. And their fatty liver would be resolved. And then when we took them back up, we would utilize little techniques that would help delay the point at which they would start to experience insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. So we could put more muscle on them for a longer period of time. Eventually, you will accumulate fat with muscle. And at some point, you're going to have to diet down again to resensitize yourself.
Yeah.
It's just like dieters. You always lose muscle when you diet. The goal is to lose as little as possible.
Right.
And when you lose a lot and you diet too hard, that's when you get tired and have all of these health problems. And then what often happens is that people rebound too quickly and they'll add a lot of fat. And your yo-yo dieters will keep losing more and more muscle in a diet and gaining more and more fat in the rebound, in the weight regain. And they eventually end up, after doing this numerous times, in a very metabolically compromising position where it's harder and harder to lose weight and easier to gain weight. So my big athletes, we do a few things. We get a CPAP on them, which dramatically helps with insulin sensitivity and blood pressure. Get vitamin D3 in them. They generally, I find them to be in a low, like in the teens with vitamin D3, which is terrible. And that helps with insulin sensitivity and helps with their sleep. We get choline into their diet, which really helps prevent or cure fatty liver. It's very beneficial for the liver and for decreasing the fat accumulation. And then what we'll do is we actually use a lower fat diet to gain weight. We push carbs. It's harder for carbs to convert into fat. People, I know, think there's an insulin monster out there, and if you eat a carb, your insulin's going to spike and you're going to be stored as fat. It's not that simple. It's harder to turn carbs into fat than it is to turn fat into fat, but you have to have, you can't have both high fat and high carb, because then, the fat will get stored as fat very, very quickly. And so we do a lower fat, higher carb diet. We implement these 10-minute walks again, as I mentioned earlier, which really helps with the, decrease the peak glucose and insulin secretion and the duration. And so about 30 minutes after a meal, we'll have them take a brisk 10-minute walk. And it's twice as effective as metformin for decreasing blood sugars. That's the number one prescribed medication in the world for type 2 diabetes. And so all of my big athletes, you got 400-pound guys taking 10-minute walks after every meal, or they'll have a bike in their garage and they'll spin on that. That's something that I utilize not only with little Nadia Wyatt, you know, you may Miss Olympia figure competitor, but I use with 440-pound Hofthor Bjornsson. All of my athletes do 10-minute walks after meals, dramatic improvement on digestion, on blood sugars, on delayed onset muscle soreness and recovery. You just feel fantastic on these. So that's part of the vertical diet. I say if you're not getting 7 hours of sleep, you're not on the vertical diet. If you're not taking 10-minute walks after meals, you're not on the vertical diet. Before you even get to food, We need to talk about the lifestyle that you need to habitually engage in order to be successful.
It's hugely important. I wanted to ask you now, when you're having them do a 10-minute walk, how important is the heart rate when they're walking?
It's not terribly important. I think that exercise is fantastic for general health. And you certainly want to get some heart rate elevation. A brisk walk can do that. That can bring you up to about a 13-minute mile, maybe 6 mets as it's measured. And that can impart a significant health benefit for all-cause mortality or, you know, just general health. I use the weight training to spike heart rate a little higher. You know, I might shorten rest periods. And certainly if you do any significant intensity, your heart rate's going to get up. That's going to give you your kind of your HIIT influence. But I want to be cautious to say, and I mentioned earlier, I don't assign 4 a.m. cardio to any of my clients because I don't want to impact their sleep. And I don't have them do 40-minute treadmill sessions twice a day. None of my clients do that, even at a competitive level.
Yeah.
And here's why. It's not terribly effective for weight loss. More exercise does not equal more weight loss. They've studied this extensively. It's great for health, but its impact on weight loss is not terribly significant. It's very small when you measure two groups, one that just diets and one that diets and exercises. In terms of fat loss, very close.
Yeah.
And so I want to be cautious not to have people running out and doing a whole bunch of exercise to lose weight when that's not what it's most effective for, because it's not terribly sustainable either. The idea that you give a client a 40-minute treadmill session every night and think they're going to do that, and certainly not enjoyably, for any extended period of time,
it's not going to happen.
It's a non-starter. And so you've already set someone up for failure.
Yeah.
And then you've kind of nocebo'd them into thinking that they have to do that if they want to lose weight. And if they don't do that, then they might as well just jump off the program and hit the fridge because it's just, you know, they can't comply with the program. So I don't look at cardio as significant for weight loss. I do the 10-minute walks for digestion, for blood sugar control. You can elevate your heart rate, of course, you know, just a brisk walk. And it's fantastic for general health. But for me, we focus on calorie restriction for weight loss, which is the most effective method, and then weight training for lean body mass retention to hold on to your muscle tissue.
Right.
Those are the two huge things that we focus on.
Yeah. You know, of course, Vince Gironda wasn't a believer of doing cardio. It was when you got people ready for competitions, no cardio. He didn't believe in that. And I think Platts was the same way. I don't think he did much cardio. And one of the things that I learned, again, you know, we tried ourselves to see. I thought, logically speaking, I thought, okay, and this is what the way a lot of people think. I thought, okay, if 30 minutes, because I was told, look, back then it was like, okay, don't do any more than 25 minutes of cardio at one time. That's the way I learned that. And yet, as years went by, I learned about you get a cardio benefit and results from doing 10-minute walks. You know, that short, three different 10-minute walks gives you more benefit than one session. I learned that too. But when I did one show, I thought, I'm going to try this just for the hell of it, which is a hard lesson to learn because you put so much into your damn training, you know, months of it. But I thought, okay, if 25 minutes is good, 3 hours probably is better. Well, you know where that went. You know, I was skinny fat.
Yes, and that happens to me, and it happens to a lot of people, is that it's the wrong stimulus. The muscle says, hey, this muscle, the body says, this muscle is heavy. It has a high oxygen demand, it has a high water demand. if you want me to walk on this treadmill for 2 hours a day, I got to get rid of some of this muscle.
Yeah.
It's just not the right stimulus.
So your body's actually doing what's supposed to.
Yeah. So Flex did the same thing with me. I worked with Flex Wheeler starting back in 2008. And we still work together all the way up to today. He just lives down the street from me here in Las Vegas. And he did the same thing. He had me do no cardio. And we just trained twice a day. So that's what I do with a lot of my female clients who are actually competitive, is we'll just do an AM PM split and have them do more of the specific hypertrophy stimulus so they don't lose any muscle tissue throughout their dieting phase. Yeah. Or very, very little is the goal.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, because, you know, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. And when it came to, you talked about, you don't normally have people doing high fat or you have them doing a low fat diet and higher carbs and not fat and carbs. Now, one of the things that I experienced, and I learned this through the anabolic diet when I was carb loading on the weekend, when I first started doing the carb loading, I really increased my caloric intake by at least 50 to 75% on the weekends because I was trying to create, put stress on the body. So it's secrete growth hormone. There was reasons I was doing that. And I had my calories in a way that I was controlling my weight. I had it to where I wanted it to be based on how I was eating during the week. But anyway, my point is, so when I carb loaded on the weekend, what I felt, cause I was eating 10,000 calories a day on the weekend when I was more in the off season. But Stan, I was so lazy and lethargic. Yeah. And now here's what I learned about the macros is the minute I started adding fat to my carb loading, then what I learned about fat, and I'm curious to know what your opinion is that when you put fat along with carbohydrates, like I did, it slows the release of sugar into your bloodstream. So fat was actually controlling that release instead of me getting that large spike, which made me crash. What's your take on that? Because that's how I thought fat was very, very useful.
Yeah, a few things. One, if you're very insulin sensitive, if you're relatively lean and you carry a significant amount of muscle tissue and you're training regularly, you can handle more glucose boluses. We call the glycemic load, how much carbohydrates are in a single meal.
Yeah.
You'll be able to manage those better because the muscle acts as a sink. And you don't have a lot of body fat, and so you're very effectively partitioning those nutrients. I mentioned with some of my big athletes talking about getting fat or not stronger because of metabolic syndrome, they would have the same experience. When they would try and eat a lot of carbohydrates, they would get very tired. They wouldn't be able to partition those nutrients. Their body would be jacking up tons and tons of insulin, which would just exhaust them. So you have to kind of look at what's the body fat of the athlete, what's their activity level. It's kind of why we like training twice a day as well, that extra stimulus, the hypertrophy stimulus, creating that sink for glucose. Another thing, though, is in terms of slowing down the absorption of the carbohydrates, we could just increase the fiber. We don't have to add the fat.
That's a good point.
Yep. And then the 10-minute walks. We can dramatically decrease the peak and the duration, called the area under the curve of the glucose and insulin spike, by taking that 10-minute walk after meals and spacing the carbohydrates out throughout the day. So there's some strategies to use, and it really kind of is dependent on all of those variables.
Right. What's your take on when I was in Bulgaria, I learned about it's virtually impossible to train the physiology. I don't know if I told you the last time, but I was actually in the Olympic training centers in Bulgaria, Russia, Czechoslovakia, back in the 80s, late 80s. Yeah. And one of the things, Bulgarians were fascinating. They were amazing to me, way ahead of their time. And they were 8 years ahead of the information out here in the West. But they said it's virtually impossible to overtrain the physiology if you don't train that long. In other words, they did like 20 to 30 minute training sessions, and they trained five times a day, you know. And I never forgot that. So what's your take on that? Like, for example, when you're training, how long is your training session?
Yeah, bodybuilding would be an hour twice a day. Powerlifting, it would just be once a day for probably 2 hours because your rest periods are longer.
Yeah.
So that was the way we went at it. But I followed that the Bulgarian method closely. I've seen Dan Green, one of the highly regarded and successful powerlifters in this industry, has implemented that throughout his training. The biggest challenge is that you have to be a pretty experienced lifter and to be able to handle that kind of volume, because people get a lot of systemic fatigue from trying to train too heavy too often.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of your level of training. It's like if you tried to go out tomorrow and run a marathon without actually training for it over a period of weeks or months, you'd get crushed. Well, if you tried to implement the Bulgarian system tomorrow without gradually working at building up your body's tolerance to that kind of fatigue, you'd get crushed. Same thing's true with the bulking diets. You can't just, if you're eating 3,000 calories today, you can't start on 5,000 tomorrow.
That's a good point. Good point.
You're going to have to transition into it.
Yeah. When I went over there, one of the things I asked them, I said, you know, I was asking them, what's your take on warming up? And they said, warming up is a waste of time. That was just their stance on this. You know, they said the body becomes its function, but they said, don't go home. If you're used to warming up, you know, 3 or 4 sets before you get into what we call the working set, don't go home and try to start off with your first working set being your first set. It doesn't work that way. The body has to adapt, and it takes a while for it to adapt to you not warming up. And I did that. I came back, and it was, listen, some of the things that they talked about, you know, change is very uncomfortable. And the idea of only training, you know, 30 to 45 minutes, they said you could go up to an hour. That window was expanded to about an hour, but for sure not any more than that. But to think that I could be at my first working set with my first set, you know, obviously I'm skeptical, but I was willing to give it a shot. And you know what? Over a period of time, I was able to do that. I never warmed up. You know, if I had a slight pull or something like that, maybe one active recovery type of set, but it was just like the body becomes its function. You teach it what you want it to do, and it can be ready on demand. That was just their stance. I thought it was pretty interesting. And I was able to go in. I mean, it might not have been a lot of weight, but, you know, 315 for my first set on a bench press for me was good, and it just went from there. And I could never do that before, but the body does adapt to that. But like you're saying, you can't go from 0 to 100 overnight, for sure.
Right. And you know, that pendulum swings back and forth over the years. People like you and I have been doing this for decades. We've seen all of the trends come and go. And for a while here, there's been a big push for a lot of warm-up. This was probably 5-7 years ago. It started to kind of overwhelm the industry. You had the foam roll, and then you had to do this whole mobility thing. And 30 minutes later, you still weren't actually lifting a weight. There's some people in the industry now, some very knowledgeable, well-respected practitioners, such as the people from Barbell Medicine, Jordan Fagenbaum and Austin Baraki, or MDs that prescribe weightlifting, Barbell Medicine. They have everybody weightlift. At some level, whatever you're capable of. And that's kind of your long-term prescription. And, you know, a warm-up to them is elevate your body temperature, swing your arms around a little bit, whatever exercise that you intend to do that day. If you're going to squat, you don't need to do 45 minutes of, you know, a variety of different exercises. Go get under the bar itself and squat down and move around, you know, and get a little bit of body temperature going, you know, get a little, maybe a little bead of sweat, and then just start slowly adding plates. I've watched Klokov, you know, the Olympic weightlifting champion, with a running clock, go from the bar to 600 pounds in less than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
5 or 6 minutes doing exactly what you said. He'll just do the bar, bam, then you'll throw a plate on, and he'll go and he'll put 2 reps there, and he'll throw another plate on. And he left his camera going the whole time, and I think in less than 6 minutes he was up to a 600 pound squat.
When I was in Bulgaria, I went there twice. The second time I went, they had a Olympic meet there. There were 18 nations there, and of course I had been there just a year or two before that, you know, so I already knew how they trained and how they were just ready on demand. It was pretty fascinating, Stan, to watch these guys, because they would just, you know, a lot of these athletes would go up to the bar. Cause I asked the coaches, I said, what do you think about visualization? And they said, it doesn't work. I mean, they were just black and white about it. You know, they just said, it gives you too much opportunity to think about the shit that you're doing. Repetition is a mother's skill. That's the reason why they were doing 51 rep maxes every time that they trained in Bulgaria. But these guys, these athletes, Sam, they would come up to the bar, the Bulgarians. Well, I should say the other teams would come up, and they'd be over the bar, and they'd be doing some sort of mantra, yelling, and then they do the lift. The Bulgarians would walk out just matter-of-factly to the bar, pick the son of a bitch up, and just heave it right now. And this is 500 or 600 pounds, first set. They didn't even come out for their first set until everybody else was done with their third. That's when the Bulgarians started. They were that magnificent, man.
Yeah, I've been asked that many times over the year. What do you do to get psyched up for a big lift? And I said, I don't. I do exactly what I've done on every lift prior for months and years to make sure I execute it perfectly. And Eddie Cohn says the same thing. The bar should look just like a 700-pound squat. It should have the same exact setup, walkout,
squat,
re-rack. It should be the same.
That way you don't have to think about it. There you go. And, you know, in baseball, because my kid went on to play Major League Baseball, so I hung out with a lot of scouts during that time. And the scouts said, with regard to a hitter, they said too many hitters are thinking too much when they're in that batting, you know, they're at that plate. And he says the great ones are almost asleep at the plate because they've done the same, like what you're saying, they've done the same thing day in and day out. They don't worry where their hands are or where their feet should be. It's they're very relaxed, and then it's just a question of reacting to that 100-mile pitch coming. Because if you're thinking about that, you're going to strike out every single time.
Let's take a quick pause to tell you about something you're definitely going to want.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're going to get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian power burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
They say the same thing about running backs in football. If you have to think about it, it's too late.
You're getting crushed. Done. Yeah, you're going to get hurt.
I will wrap up the Bulgarians by saying this, and this is a precautionary principle for those people who want to go get a Bulgarian book and read it and start implementing their program. The Bulgarians recruit these athletes from a very early age.
Yep.
Their anthropometrics are measured carefully. Their parents are viewed as having contributed the genes that are necessary. And then they work them at such a high level that a lot of them burn out, and only those who have an extraordinary ability to recover. Yeah. They have a central nervous system that can overcome that kind of workload. So you're looking at a very elite group of people who have that genetic predisposition in many cases, and genetics reign supreme. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And so they are some pretty amazing athletes and these guys will start from the time they're 6 or 5 years old using a broomstick to learn the technique.
Yep.
They are judged on their technique long before their strength. They'll kind of like an ice skater would be. They score them based on the execution of the movements as opposed to how much weight's on the bar up until they're 12 or 14 years old.
Yeah, and I saw that when I was over there. I saw the kids because they showed me. I was so lucky. The Bulgarians are very open, a lot different than the Russians. When they knew the Americans were coming in to view the training and learn seminars, they took their athletes about 3 hours away. They didn't want to see them, talking to them, nothing. Bulgarians are like, come in, by the time you get this information out, we're going to be way down the road, and it's old information, But I saw the way they handle their kids, blood testing. They take blood out of their ears to find out what they needed. Yeah, exactly what you're saying. They would have kids do that stick in a dark room so they could really understand how their body was working through that space. They're amazing that way. So you're right.
It's
about
extraordinary.
That. No, it really is,
Yeah. And they're also very patient. Mikhail Kokhlaev, a famous lifter from Russia. I attended his seminar here in the United States some years ago, and he just talked about the fact that they have 5-year and 10-year plans.
Yep.
We get ready for a meet that's 3 months away.
Right.
That's just the American, the immediate gratification thing.
Yeah. Absolutely.
These guys, they plan way in advance and they don't overload themselves. Mikhail said that he would only deadlift four heavy lifts a year, over 90%. He'd go about 95% at each of the two qualifying meets for Worlds and Nationals. And then at Worlds and Nationals, he would do a max. And so these guys are really maxing out twice a year. And you have to be very disciplined and patient to do that. And in the U.S., we're maxing out every weekend on Instagram so we can get some likes.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. No,
it has changed a lot.
It's a marathon, just like bodybuilding. It's a marathon, and you got to be willing to tolerate that. And there's a lot of shit that you got to learn along the way, and it's not all successful or happy endings.
Yes, indeed.
You know,
One question before we exit. This has been a fantastic interview, man. You're a wealth of knowledge.
Thank you.
When you're, what's your take on for bodybuilding purposes about implementing smaller rest periods compared to longer rest periods? Like a powerlifter, you need more time in between each set. And again, I'm not a powerlifter, so I may be talking out of my butt right now. But with bodybuilding, I think that part of the success for me was being able to move through my training session only resting, ideally, 30 seconds. No longer than 30 seconds. If I could do it in less than that, because I thought that the resting that short period of time like that created the intensity that gave me even more results. What's your feeling on that?
I think it depends on the body part. If you do a set and you don't rest long enough to be able to do a second set and get pretty close to the same amount of reps, obviously you're going to go from 10 to 9 to 8 or so. But if you go from 10 to 2, you haven't rested long enough.
True.
And so, and that would be more dramatic, say, on a squat or a really hard set of leg presses.
Yeah.
Than it would be on a lat pull down.
Right.
You can rest for a shorter period of time. So I do like, all the metabolic benefits of all the blood flowing into the muscle and maintaining that pump. So I move reasonably quickly through my workout. I kind of sometimes will do antagonistic body parts. I'll do a dip, rest 30 seconds, do a chin, rest 30 seconds, do a dip, right, and go that way.
Yeah.
And that way I get just enough rest for the chest to where when I do my next set of chest, I can still get a reasonable number of repetitions. It doesn't crater in terms of the total number of reps, but I've got this my oxygen, my cardiovascular system's getting worked. I get these great pumps.
Yeah.
I like that part. I feel like, and this is particularly true of leg day, because when I trained with Flex, he would have us do mostly 15 to 20 rep sets with 90 second rest periods. And during a portion of that rest period, he would make you squat down and sit in a squat with your quad stretched and burning,
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and he would take us through, a pretty significant amount of volume in less than an hour, and your legs would just be just full and pumped, but also your cardiovascular system would be enormously taxed.
Yeah.
It was something that you had to gradually over time train for. When I first dove into Flex's workout, I'm a strong bodybuilder. I mean, I'm a power lifter.
Right.
So I would load, 14 plates a side on the leg press and have somebody sit on it, do some reps. When I first started with Flex and he started doing those 90 second rest periods, I went from 14 plates to 12 plates to 10 plates to 8 plates. And I could barely get 8 plates. I think I even went down to 6 the first couple of workouts, because every 90 second spot, I had to take weight off or I wouldn't be able to get my 20 reps or 15 to 20 reps.
Yeah.
And it was hard on the ego initially to be struggling with 6 plates on each side on the leg press. To me, my girlfriend does more than that. And I'm like, but what happened is week over week, my conditioning improved so much that I was able to go from 6 to 7 to 8 to 10, eventually to 12 plates for, the 5 sets of 20 with 90 second rests.
Right.
And that was a progression. And, everything in bodybuilding is about a progression.
Right.
More sets, more reps, more weight. That's the underlying foundation to building muscle.
Right.
And so that was the progression. My cardio got good enough to where I could be strong with those short rest periods. So again, when you were doing that, you were very well conditioned. And did you ever notice that when you wake up the next morning after a what I call a really, metabolic workout like that, where your heart rate's going and you're just sucking wind through the whole workout, you wake up the next morning and you're just shredded. You got veins in your abs.
Yep.
That is what I look for when I train athletes for bodybuilding shows. That's how I condition them. Not with 40 minutes on the treadmill at the 3.0,
That
doesn't do it. Doesn't do it.
Good point. Hey, listen, I just want to tell you, anytime that you want to come back on this show to talk about anything, I mean, we just did a, basically almost an hour just on diet, really. I mean, we talked about training. Anytime you want to come back on and share, I'd love to have you on. And hopefully you don't mind if one of these days I get back with you again and ask you to come back on, because it's, you know, this is the kind of stuff I think that people really need to hear, because there's some things that are just truths. And I think that we've spoken a lot of that here today. And that's, there's a lot of that missing, I think, in today's environment, in my opinion.
Well, it'd be my honor. Keep collecting questions from your viewers, and I'm happy to come back and answer them. That's a great deal. Thank you.
Beautiful, man. Listen, stay safe, be well. I hope your places stay open, and keep training like a wild man. You look great.
I got a garage gym. I'm golden.
There you go. All right, man. You have a good day, okay?
Take care, brother.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.